Good evening, world. Welcome to another episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Albert Dicady and Emmanuel Coffey. Good evening, counsel.
Counsel, good evening. Good morning, wherever you may be listening to us, in whatever time you are. And hopefully you are having either tea or coffee joining the IP Breakfast. Welcome.
Yes, this is indeed a great time. A lot going on in the IP world. Today, we're actually going to have a guest. And counsel, can you introduce our guest? It is not yet online. And as we wait for him, we'll do some more talk about, I guess, IP in COVID, because it's very fitting.
Yes, it is fitting to really talk about COVID. A vaccine is out there, and I guess UPS and FedEx and everybody else is getting ready to deliver the first portion, I should say, of the this COVID-19 vaccines.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, this is kind of not the same conversation we'll be talking to about Ron, but tell them a little bit about who's our guest today.
Ron Hunter is an alumnus of Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. I understand he also attended the Chicago Law School of Business. But when he comes in, he'll go into more detail into his background. But he's been in this business for quite a long time.
Yes, in terms of a second part of the segment.
Yeah, in terms of IP and intangible assets and startups and the process of getting your idea to the market and things of that nature. So he should he should bring us valuable information in that area. But in the meantime, we should also talk about our book of The Value of Your Ideas.
Yes, The Value of Your Ideas. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and a lot of other online vendors that you can find a book. It is, I think it's a good primer for anybody who does not know much about intellectual property and who would like to know what intellectual property is and also how to take advantage of it. The most important thing is really how do I use this intellectual property for me, for my business or and any other propositions. But in a more theoretical and understanding of the world of IP is to look at IP in its global aspect and how it infiltrates every aspect. Like we were talking earlier today, we were talking about Mr. Hunter is with us, but let's finish this piece here, counsel. When we talk about COVID, and this week we had an announcement that the FDA has approved and also the CDC has approved the Pfizer vaccine, and it will be start to administer so we have a little bit of noise here. Sorry for the noise. And so again, a lot of IP is going on there, and science in general, which is protected by IP, is bringing us a solution, a much needed solution for this situation and that's going on with COVID-19.
Yeah, although I may just add quickly that it's very controversial, this vaccine. There are a lot of, scientists of all backgrounds have ideas about the vaccine itself, but this is not the forum to address this right now.
No, but I mean, it is technology. obviously, right? You have a lot of technology. This is a new technique of doing a vaccine, and the world is skeptical about how it was created, how come it was so fast. The other ones used to take longer. And this is all about this new technology and this new that are protected also by patents. And there'll be a lot of invention in that realm, and see how it works. Obviously, it's been administered in England for about a week now. So there'll be more data. In the United States, it will be administered to different people based on a particular need, I guess, or people who should get it first. But obviously, there'll be each time a person takes the vaccine, it's an opportunity to have more data on how it will behave in a human body. But today we just wanted to talk about that. Again, our book, which talks to you about intellectual property, it's a must-have. It's the best gift that you can give someone during this holiday season. How to turn their ideas into something tangible and perhaps even make money about it. So instead of giving them a $25 gift, give them the gift of book. That's a gift that will continuously give to them.
It's a lifetime gift.
Yes, it's a lifetime gift. Council, we do have Mr. Ron Hunter with us today. I will let you do the introduction.
All right. Again, as Council stated, we have with us Mr. Ron Hunter. He's a prolific, marketing type of person, technologist, and I'll let him introduce himself. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
Yeah,
we can hear you well.
Thank you for the opportunity to join you fine men on this podcast. I've listened to other ones with you guys and really find it to be insightful and very helpful.
Great. Could you tell us a little bit about your background?
I'll give you a quick snapshot. Let's see. I have a bachelor's of engineering degree from Stevens Institute of Technology in physics. I have I did a double master's degree at the University of Chicago, doing an MBA and another degree in economics at the University of Chicago. I'm proud to note that when I was at the University of Chicago, my professors during the time that I was there, over a 3-year period, the professors that I was actually studying with, 5 of them got Nobel Peace Prizes during that time in economics. So it's known as the number one economics and finance school in the country. After the University of Chicago, most notably, I worked for Deloitte Consulting, helping to restructure large companies. And then in 95, I left Deloitte to join, 96, I left Deloitte to join some small startups. I've worked in the venture capital industry, helping to actually finance companies. So I've sat on both sides of the table, raising capital, as well as making the decisions on what capital to invest and how to structure those deals. I worked for a company called Cyient. This is going to be very notable for our discussion tonight, because at Cyient, we focused on startups, particularly for internet-based companies, but the methodologies that we developed and the thinking that we developed really apply to any startup. And I've been working with startup companies, helping to start companies, helping companies get financed since about that time. So I guess for about the last 30 years or so.
That is awesome, and that is extensive indeed, your experience in the field. Today we are, in this program, we are going to focus on the layperson who does not have the experience, the know-how, the knowledge to take an idea and move it forward to turn it into a product or and later on into a business. So we would like you to take us through the process. In our book, we talk about you know, how somebody can take an idea and protect the idea, whether that idea is something that is should be copyrightable or have a trademark or have a patent or kept secret.
Right.
So, you know, so once they have, let's say they have an idea, they have seen an attorney and they have somehow secured their ideas, how do they go from that step to create a startup and fund a startup?
So one place I want to start is that I don't know that whether or not you know it or not, but or your audience might know it, but startups have a rate of failure of about 90%. Right, so, and it goes through years. So, you know, like during the first year, probably 30% of them drop out. And then during the second year, 30% drop out. The first year, around 21%. And then by the fifth year, you're going at 50%. And then by 10 years, you're upwards of 90% of startups fail.
And this is the reason for a program like this, right? To share best practices and share failures and successes with our audience, so that we can reduce that number, so that more of them become successful even in the first try.
Exactly.
Now, knowing that. Not every idea is going to flourish to big things, but with a program like this, with your what you'll be telling them, how can they start something and avoid these pitfalls?
That's exactly why I provided those statistics, is because in the last about 20 years, starting at the time that I was 20 years. It's 30 years. But started at around the time that I was at the company Scient, we started to formulate some thinking around how to scientifically create startups. Right? Prior to that time, startups were created by essentially a guy has an idea and he works really hard at trying to take idea to start up to bigger company. But there was no methodology, there was no framework to guide them, to make sure they asked the right questions from the beginning. In 1999, we started to formulate that and apply what's called the scientific method to creating startups. And utilizing that methodology, we were able to create companies like Hotwire, WebMD, Realtor.com, Major League Baseball, and essentially our hit rate was about 65%. That is, if you worked with us, you're still here. 65% of those companies are still out there, and at least four of them are multi-billion-dollar institutions. So what I'm about to go into is something that has been formulating over since the 2000 period, so about 20 years or so, not 30, about 20 years or so. And it has actually been documented now by Stanford, and it's being taught to their MBA students, and it's something called the Lean Startup. So I'm giving you the highlights. A person has a concept, right? Because they've been working in the industry, or like sometimes I use like a pizza parlor owner, you know, he wakes up one morning before he does a startup and he has a great pizza recipe. So they have some concept that they think will bring value to the world or that they can monetize. But the problem with most startups is that they formulate them in the in what we call the closet. That is, they look at themselves in the mirror and go, oh, that's a really good concept. Let's go, you know, withdraw all of our savings and make this happen. And that's where we see high amounts of failure rate over time, because they haven't gone through what I'm about to describe at the very first phase. And that is what we call discovery. The discovery phase is when what you want to do is take that concept, define, first you want to define whether or not there is a marketplace for it, right? This requires research. If you don't know how to do the research, you can get with people who know how to do the research, but pretty much you get a lot of that research on Google today, right? Years ago, Google didn't exist. There's so many tools today to help you to not fail. You may have to make a little bit of investment if you want to hire a consultant like myself or others to help you to define that. But the first thing you want to do is say, here's my concept, and here's the group of people that I think will want to utilize that concept. And really define them, right? There are, the guy's name is John. He's an engineer. He has two kids. He lives in New Jersey. He uses this type of tech phone. Right, you build something called a persona, right? And it's like person with the letter A after it, persona. And then what you want to do is go out and start with defining the marketplace, saying how many people are out there that would want to buy something like that, right? And what you're doing now is creating a hypothesis from the scientific point of view, right? That you believe that this many people will want to buy this type of service. Having defined that hypothesis and gone out and done the research and found that there probably is a population of people that want to buy this product, I mean, that want to buy this type of service, you would then go and start to define what that service might look like or what that product might look like. Once you're doing that, right? So you say, you know, here, there are many different ways of coloring a wall blue. You can paint it with a paintbrush, you can use a hose. There are many different ways. Your product is gonna be one of those specific areas. So what you're trying to do is say, here's the product that I can do to fit my concept to go after this marketplace. And then at that point in time, you want to go into something called a product market fit. You want to be able to go out and recruit people that you would then ask with surveys, what do you want to do with this product? What might that product look like? And start to really push out the features. You might even do a little prototype, like maybe a drawing of the product, these types of things, and put it in front of people might be part of that target audience and say, okay, would you buy this product? Right? So at this point in time, you're trying to test your hypothesis that there is a market, and then within that, that this product would fit that marketplace.
Right. So a lot of due diligence before you even go out there and try to implement
Implement the idea, before you get a trademark and a copyright, you're at the very conceptual phase, right? This is like the first month of starting to even think about this, to say, do I actually have a market? Is there a market for what I'm talking about? And do I have a product that would fit that market? Right, and you just want to take a sampling size. And there are lots of tools to do that today, right? Email surveys, Facebook, right? Online surveys. There are many, many tools that are very cheap that you can get out there and collect that type of data.
A person who wants to do that, who doesn't know how, there are help out there, right? I mean, like you said, there are tools, but if I still don't know how to use the tool, there are people who sell these services that you can consult.
Exactly. You know, right? So working with Emmanuel, I sell my services. I do this for a living. But yes, there are plenty of services that you can look up online that do this. There are consultants, but make sure you read the backgrounds of the consultants, because there's a huge fake consultancy also out there. Right.
You must do
your due diligence, or even the people that you're dealing with, right? They should have, you know, you should be looking for their YouTube videos. One of the first places that you should go is to LinkedIn, right? Because the LinkedIn will show the resume of the person. And although you can't verify that they did most of that work, you can see the consistency of the work that they've done over 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Or, you know, if they're younger, you know, what their last assignments were, that type of thing. Sometimes if you're about to spend real money, you know, you can even ask them for references, right? Where you'll be able to call their past clients to see how well they did. Right? See, that's the beauty of ratings and reviews these days, is that, you know, a lot of these services are being rated and reviewed, as well as, like I said, you can ask them directly for references.
So let's assume that you know, due diligence is done, you do the hypothesis, you do some surveys, and the numbers look good. Now you've met with your attorney, your attorney guides you through the process and decides with you what type of intellectual property that you should secure. And let's say you've done that step. Since we've dropped counsel, Coffee dropped the call. I don't know what happened. So we won't talk about that, since we also have that. We have some segments, some episode about those process of getting patent, trademarks, and copyright, and so on. And it's also the subject covered in the book, The Value of Your Ideas. So let's leapfrog that and talk about the idea of, now that I have maybe a viable startup, but how do I start? I don't have much money to start the project. What are the sources of money that you would recommend somebody to get going from day zero and then move forward as the project progression?
And so there are phases to your startup. I want to talk about the word startup for give me a second. I want to talk about the word startup in general. That word just defines a form of company. It really is a definition of where you are and kind of your evolution of the company. Right, so a startup is something that's going to go away. Right, it's you've started it up, and then you're going to hit a certain level when you start to actually get sales, that you're now a small business. You know, and then you're going to move through different phases of going to, you know, becoming a medium-sized business, if not a large institutional corporation.
Yeah. Right, that's the goal. The goal is to become as big as the biggest guys, right? Right, but hey,
so you started your startup, and what you're doing. So now that you've defined that you have a marketplace, you define that you have this product, it is the perfect time to talk to the lawyers to make sure you get your trademarks and your copyrights done, because now you're bringing in more people that are going to be involved.
Hello, can you guys hear me?
Now we can hear you, yes.
All right, I got a question for you, though. Let's go back to the market study in terms of, what if your product is so new and revolutionary that you can't find any data for it? What about that?
That's a very good question. Then what you're trying to do remember, when you are, your concept, any concept of a business is there to solve a problem for the customer. No matter how revolutionary it is, at the end of the day, what pain are you solving for a customer? So whether or not it is a new pizza formula in which you're going to serve new pizza, right? You're solving my problem that I am a pizza connoisseur and I want to buy that slice of pizza because I'm going to like its taste. Or whether or not you're Elon Musk and you're going to launch new rockets that will go to the moon and do moon mining for rare minerals, right? Very different solutions, but they are solving a problem. And when you are defining your market may not have already been defined, but you can always find, are there large groups of people in which this is going to solve a problem for? And then if I'm solving that problem, what is the economic value to solve that problem? How much are they potentially willing to pay? Because when I solve the problem, they're going to gain this much value. Value being defined either by dollars or just what do they call utility, a sense of gain. They're going to gain that amount, and therefore they should be willing to pay this amount.
Yeah, but I'm not sure you. Let's say when Apple first introduced the first iPhone, right?
Yes.
There wasn't a market for it because
There was a market for it. The problem that if you read about it, and I've done like we've done case studies on that. The problem was that people were trying to walk around. People like listening to music, right? At that point in time, the way that you could listen to music walking around, you were either in your car on the radio or you would have those big boom boxes. But technology has started to miniaturize. Right, so even though it was something that nobody else had seen before, the problem of solving taking your music along with you was the problem that they were solving at that point in time.
Okay, so let's get back to the finance. Time is really moving. I think we're gonna excuse our audience that for our this episode will be longer, just because we think that this is so much valuable information, and we really want our audience to have that information. So please indulge with us, and
you'll probably have to do a series on this.
We probably will have to do that, but we'll let's get into the idea that we have the startup and we need some money. And I look in my bank account, I didn't find much. I need some money to get going.
So let's go through that process. The phases, right? That you're moving from the place where you've done the product market fit and you've defined that there is a marketplace. Now you're getting to a place where you're going to, after you've talked to people about your copyright and your trademarks, you're gonna probably start building a prototype so that you can get it out there so somebody can touch it, right, and interface with it. Then once you've gone past that phase, you're gonna start to build what's called a sales roadmap and trying to figure out how are you actually going to sell this product, right? Once you have and what you're doing along the way is every time that you do something, there's a line of demarcation that comes, and once you're going over the other line, you're verifying the previous line, right? So I verify my product market exists. I verify that people will want my product. I put a prototype out there, and I verified how the people would interact with my product. Now I want to verify that they will actually buy it and how I would actually get to them as far as like through sales funnels. Once I have that, now I want to, now I have some customers, I have some dollars, and now I need to scale that. Along the same path is how you raise your capital and the sources. I put together a whole document on a one-page document that shows the correlation between those phases and where you're going to raise your capital from.
Okay. Right. So let's go through it very quickly today to kind of like, okay, I have an idea. I need some, I look for my bank account. There is a great idea, but I don't have much money.
So the very first place is friends and family. You're going to look into your savings account. You're going to go to your friends. You're going to go to your family. Right at this point in time, you should not be looking to raise a lot of money. You're looking to raise money to get incorporated. You're looking to raise money to do those surveys that we were just talking about. Right? With that data, now you can start going. With that data, now you're going to build your prototype. You're still dealing with your friends and family money, because what professional investors are going to look for is that you have at least some traction. You have at least some customers, right? So you have your friends and family money. Then you might, once you have like the prototype in hand with a couple of customers that are saying, I would buy that from you if you existed, right? You get that information. There are ways of configuring your surveys and getting information from them where you can see that a customer base is waiting for this product to come to market. Once you've done that, now you go into what's called seed capital. Now, the seed capital game has changed over the last 20 years. It used to be made up of essentially high net worth individuals, like doctors or lawyers, who want to talk about it. Remember, we used to always have this thing that, you know, and lawyers and doctors, they're going to come out and they're going to cut you a $25,000 check because they can afford to do that. And the reason that they're going to do it is so they can have something to really talk about at their next cocktail party, right? They can talk about the cool little startup that they've invested in. But yeah, so that group of high net worth individuals.
They have to be accredited.
Yes, they are accredited investors. They're high net worth individuals. In America, you can get up to 35 non-accredited investors before you have to go to accredited investors. So that group of people right there that may not be friends and family, but you know, they're high net worth individuals. You get your next level of money from them. Then you get into the early parts of professional investing, which is called angel investors. These people are also high net worth individuals, but they are more professional in how they do due diligence. Those other guys, they're investing in you because of you. They're primarily investing in you and your concepts, and because they like you, and that's what they're buying, right? And because the concept sounds good, but they're really heavily investing in you. The next level, the angel investors, are going to be investing also in you, but they'll do more due diligence on whether or not the market exists and whether or not the product that you're talking about exists. And that's where all the surveys that you were doing in the first part of this come into play. They're going to read through those surveys. They're going to look at the business plan. They're going to look at your financial plan and make sure, a lot of places that people go wrong is that they put together financial plans that actually do not resemble the business plan. So the business plan might say, this is how we're going to sell the product. And then in a financial plan, they're not hiring any salespeople. So they look for problems like that.
Right. And also, I think there's a Work Act which created the new finance mechanism for crowdfunding, which allows non-accredited investors to invest. At least we're talking
about crowdfunding, yes. America.
So this is not something we'll be able to get into much today, but I wanted to just say it here today as a source. But I definitely think we're going to have more sessions. So in phase, this is you are in phase
once
one.
Once you've gone past your angel investors, now you get into venture capital, right? And so now you're at what we call the Series A, your seed round. Now you're into your Series A, and from there you get into very professional financing. But it goes along the same path of the phases that you are, and essentially proving your value. And this is very different than it used to be, right? When I, back in 99, you would go to a venture capitalist with just a 5-page PowerPoint presentation, and then they would cut you a $5 million check. But that didn't mean just because you were able to put together a PowerPoint presentation did not mean that you were able to create a business. Now they are more fine-tuned and it's better for the marketplace because less crap essentially gets out into the marketplace. But yeah, so that's, there's a whole path that we can discuss in future podcasts on the details, like what you need to have done, you know, with each step before you get to the next step and before you get to the next groups of financiers.
Yes, definitely, Ron. I think we will have to send you another invitation to continue the process and get into a little bit deeper of the different phases for our audience. Our goal is to share ideas with our audience so that we reduce the learning curve, we reduce the rate of failure, and so we can have so everybody can have more success. And you know, the more I guess success also breeds success, but also there'll be failures, and we have to take these failures as also part of the success, because every time you fail in something, it tells
you one other way. And that's a really good point that people have to understand. In this game of startup, there's a statistic out there that says before they have succeeded, most people have committed bankruptcy and or failed at their startup at least 7 times before they hit the stride, right? Because what they're doing, and this is a key thing that came out of the learnings out of Silicon Valley, is that there's two sides of failure, right? Where one is you failed, you're disappointed, and you've lost your money and these types of things. The other side is that you've learned what not to do. And if you learn,
right, you know, fail and fail,
exactly,
fail and fail,
you know, and if you take away that learning, you know, you can move forward and know not to do that the next time. And but a lot of this, like I said, inside of the lean startup, the statistics, there's lots of data out there today that if you go and look for best practices, some things you should not be bumping your head against. You should decrease the amount of times that you've done, that you're going to do things that lead to failure, because there's a lot of data out there these days on what not to do, including this show.
Yes. A great way to end it for today. What we've learned today from our guest today, Ron Hunter, who is an engineer and also has a business degree from none other than Chicago School of Business, was running through us a couple of ideas. And one of the things that I will remember here is that you have to do your due diligence. Do your due diligence before you start putting money out. And we will invite Ron again to give you more. We hope that you like this segment. We're disconnected for some reason with
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Coffee. Ah, yes, I can hear you now.
Yes, I look forward to coming back.
All right. Great. It was, again, it was a great episode. Like you just said, we hope our audience will benefit from it, and hopefully they'll tune back in again when we do have Ron again on the air. And I guess time goes by fast when you're having fun.
Yes, since we have Ron here, I don't know if we'll come. Well, we won't ask you to commit online, but we will try to get. We will try to reschedule in another.
Oh no, we can put a schedule on it. I mean, if you would like to give a date,
this time future,
just in case somebody wants.
All right. I mean, maybe we should continue this conversation next week, and so we can get
into next week. The 20th works for me.
The subject.
Okay.
All right. So there you have it. You know, so next week we will continue with more. If you didn't get all your answers, you can actually tweet me on Twitter. That's at ADKD, ADECADY, at ADKD on Twitter. And you can find us also at the value of your ideas at gmail.com. You can find
at Coffee Law LLC. It's at COFFYLAW LLC. Until next week, be well.
All right, gentlemen. Bye
bye. Bye bye now. Thank you very much, Ron. Good morning, world. Welcome to another episode of the IP Breakfast with attorneys Albert Dicady and Emmanuel Coffey. Good morning, counsel.
Counsel, good morning. Good morning, everyone, from wherever you may be listening. At whatever time, hopefully you are having coffee as you listen to this new episode.
Yes, I have my coffee here. I'm ready. Today, we will continue the conversation we had with Ron Hunter, a graduate of the Business School of Chicago University. Just to remind everybody that Chicago University is the best business school in the United States, arguably by those who may have graduated from Harvard, Dartmouth, and UPenn. And other schools, that is the that seems to be the jury's verdict out there. So just to tell you the type of personalities that we are bringing to you in this episode, counsel.
Today we'll go over the different stages of financing of your corporation and the and also the pitfalls that may lie in your as you move from one form of financing to the other.
Yes, last week we went quickly on somebody having an idea and you wanna obviously register. You know, we talk about due diligence, talking to an attorney, doing some research, creating, selecting a trademark or business name that we have shown that is a little bit more complex than people think. Just choosing these things have to be done in a manner, thinking strategically on how you're going to use it later, and make sure that you have no conflict and no later confusion where you start a business under a name and later you find that you are infringing on somebody else's name and you have to change the business name and redo advertising and waste money that way. So we talk highly about due diligence. Due diligence can be done with help, professional help as well. We always advocate that while a lot of things in America or in the world can be done by you, especially certainly in America, you can take care of any legal matters on your own, at your own peril, though. So we do advise that people do seek legal advice and professional advice in doing these things. So we start from ideas and then we created a company and which we call a startup. And Ron went into, how do you start a startup and how do you get some seed money to start your project and the different phases that that there are, going to an angel, going to venture capitalists and round one, round two. And eventually maybe even take your business to a stock market and make it a public company. So
right, let me preface the conversation by also saying that many big companies start have a humble beginning. If you take HP for example, Hewlett Packard, right, the guy started out of his garage.
Now, not just Hewlett Packard. That's the same for Apple. That's the same for the mammoth that is called Amazon today. There's so many companies that have started in the garage.
Okay. So just because you are a startup, you are at the beginning stage, and it's a very humble beginning, you don't have the funds, the resources, should not discourage you. That's why we're saying.
Yeah, and this is why you're listening to this IP Breakfast today, and we do hope that you would not only listen to this episode, go back and listen to other episodes. We have some noise in the background. Sorry about that. But we are trying to bring this information to you so that you can actually do the best possible with that information and know from how you can take your ideas from ideas to all the way to the end. And we also want you to take a look from our book, which is The Value of Your Ideas. It's available on Amazon. It will make for, as we are in the holiday season, it will make a perfect gift for a friend. It's a gift that will keep on giving. Yes, but we do have Mr. Hunter with us. We do also have some background noise that is, if we could reduce that, we were trying to reduce the noise in the background.
Do you still hear noise?
Now we're good. Council Coffee, are you going to introduce Mr. Ron?
Well, yes, thank you. This is for the second time. If you listened to the last episode, we had Mr. Ron Hunter. He introduced himself, his credentials, and his background. And today is the continuation of the last episode. So with us, without further ado, I'll let Mr. Hunter have it. Go ahead.
Well, good morning, Mr. Hunter.
Good morning, gentlemen. Counselors, esteemed esquires. So,
good morning.
Can you hear any background noise now?
We are way better now.
Okay. I put in headphones. Excellent. So last we left our story, we had an entrepreneur who had a concept. And what we're trying to do, we talked a lot about what he had to do to kind of get that concept off the ground and going. But every concept, every business requires this fuel called cash. You can't get around it, right? So you have to plan for how you're going to get that cash, right? The entrepreneur saying is cash is king, because it's all about cash to keep doors open, to keep people fed. So going through the steps that I talked about last week, I created a chart that essentially synchronizes, as you're growing, what you have to do to go out and get the requisite cash and where that cash might be coming from. So under the Lean Startup, we have the development of your company, right? To get it going through four phases. One is discovery phase. The second one is customer validation. The third one is customer creation. And then the fourth one is starting to scale the company. During the discovery phase, as we talked about last week, that's when you're trying to really just define, just because you have a concept, you don't know that you're going to get customers. So you're going out and interviewing and getting an understanding of what problem that you're solving for the customers. Now, this is a key thing, because when you sit in front of investors, whether or not they're your mom trying to, you know, get the money out of the cookie jar, or, you know, Uncle Ed trying to get him to turn in those war bonds, you're going to have to explain to them why you think this is such a great idea and convince them that, you know, that this is something worthy. So even before you go to your family. And this is something that in our community is not readily taught, right? Even before you go to your family, make sure you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's. Make sure you're defining what is the problem that I am trying to solve. What is the value of solving that problem? Who are the target customers? You can put all that on a one sheet, on one sheet of paper. In fact, there's a framework out there that you can Google called the Lean Canvas. That's Lean Canvas. If you just Google it, you'll find it. It has 9 squares on it. And in those 9 squares, you just have to fill out those squares and you'll be able to talk to anybody about your business. Now, and you should be able to fill out those squares in about 20 to 30 minutes. There's nothing that you have to do massive research about on that time. So at that point in time, now you have something in which you can start talking to people. Now, who are going to be the sources of the funding at this point in time in your thing? Remember, you woke up yesterday, you had a concept, you spent a week putting together your lean canvas, and now you're saying, okay, now where are you going to get the money to make this happen? And as part of that lean canvas, you want to start defining how much money do you actually need and what are you going to do with that money? It's something called sources and uses of funds, right? So the source of funds would be you, Uncle Ed. What I'm going to use that on is not go to a party, right? I'm going to take what I understand about my customer base now. I'm going to go do some surveys to really fine tune that. I'm going to write up a business plan, a very lean business plan. I'm going to incorporate. I'm going to potentially get trademarks. Right here are the list of things that I'm going to go out and do with your money that prepares me to go get the next level of money. And that's all you're really trying to do. At this point in time, your primary customer are the money people. The people you're trying to get money from, that's who you're trying to, and you and your concept are the product. So at this point in time, early on, you're sitting down with the lean canvas, you're going in front of Uncle Ed, and you're saying, hey, I need this amount of money to get to this point so I can then raise the next level of money to accomplish these other goals and tasks. And that, so almost always, that money comes from friends, family, and you, right? But what money do you have in your savings account? What money can you get from your friends? What money can you get from your family? Now, the beauty of that is that your friends and your family tend to be less sophisticated investors. So you don't have to go through a deep level of due diligence and gathering information like you're going to have to do with more professional investors. Primarily, the reason that they're investing in you is a belief in the concept and a belief in you. And I really should flip that. It's more about a belief in you, right? That you're capable of doing things like this, and that you've shown kind of, you've shown your ability to define something and then follow through. They're invested in you, and then they're investing in the concept.
Now, let me ask you this. What then, because you are within your family, right? It's within your relatives and family. So if, because there is a chance you may not succeed. What happens if you do not succeed?
It's a good question. Because 90% of businesses don't succeed. If you don't succeed, you're going to go bankrupt and they're going to lose their money.
Okay. But I also want to...
And so that's why when you're raising... I'm sorry?
I wanted to interject here to that question, because I'm an avid supporter of tried again until you succeed. I mean, each time you try, you may want to try a different approach. But to Council's Coffee, if you try once and you know, Uncle Ed did not put out any money out of pocket, don't get discouraged. I think you know, you need to rethink. Maybe he's giving you good advice that maybe something is wrong in your presentation, that the person needs to rethink their presentation, what they are working on, their project, and see the validity of their project, and then retry again.
Absolutely. That's absolutely perfect advice. And you have to treat your family and your friends professionally. When you sit in front of them to raise this money, they are no longer your friends and your family. They are professionals, and you have to listen to their questions and their concerns instead of just saying, just give me the money. Right? I know you have the money, just give it to me. No, that's not how this works, because what Albert just said is key. They may have insight that you can actually value, that you can benefit from. Now, the question about what happens if you fail, yes, they lose their money. That's why you're trying to define goals. The whole key concept here is that you're trying to increase the probability of not failing. Right? By going out and doing the research, by going out and finding customers before you invest lots of money. So even this amount of money that they are first investing, you can try what we call experiments. Right? You can put together, here's what I think would happen in the market. Here's who I think my target customers are. And then you can spend $500 to go and do a Google survey to find out whether or not those are your target customers. Then, when you get that information back, you go and say, I see some things I've been thinking are not correct, so I'm going to change my business model and then go out again. So with very little money, you can actually increase the probability at the very start that you will succeed, right? And that's a key thing. One, to demonstrate to the next level of investors. Two, increasing the probability of not failing means you're going to increase the probability of giving your friends and family a return on their money. Now, I am not a lawyer. Now, I need to say that before I say this next thing. At this point in time, like I said, this has to be professional, right? So one of the things that you will have to have done before you take in the capital, you should do before you take in the capital, is go get incorporated. Typically, you want to form, at this point in time, an LLC if you're going to, if you don't think you're going to have to raise money later, or a C corporation if you think you have to raise money in the future. I don't want to get into that at this point in time, but those are the two top formations. Once you've raised that money, you want to go out and get you want to take the money in the form of a convertible note, right? So there are two ways, there are two to three ways of taking this money in. One is a convertible note, the other is just straight stock.
For our friends who are not familiar with convertible note, could you tell us what that is?
Yes. Okay, so let's talk about the stock first. A stock is just a unit of the company. So if I had a company and when I incorporated, I issued 100 shares of stock, the value of that company is equal to those 100 shares. So every time I sell a share, if I sold you one share, you own 1/100 of the company. If I sell you 10 shares, you own 10% of the company, right? So that is the, that's how you do by buying stock. A convertible note is, but now when you do that, you actually have to put, with the stock, you actually have to put a price on the company. You have to tell people, based on some algorithm, what the value is of the company at that point in time. And it's going to be a very hard thing to do, because really the value of the company is zero. Then they put in some money, and then the value of the company is whatever money that they put in. right? But you can increase the value of the company. You can say it's worth $10 million or $10, depending on what your valuation argument is. And that gets more complicated, right? So what they've come up with is something called a convertible note. A convertible note is just, it is what it is. It's a debt. It's what's called a note instrument. And so what ends up happening is that you go to Uncle Ed, you say, Uncle Ed, when you put this money in, I'm going to owe you this money, the company, not I, right? Because they split it into the company. The company will owe you this money. And if it doesn't raise the next level of money within 2 years, the company will be in a position, will pay you back the money. Right? But if it does raise that next level of money, the note will convert into stock, into regular stock, and that the valuation of that stock, the valuation of that company, will be set by the next group of guys. That gets you out of the discussion of you guys going back and forth and what the value of the company is. You say, you know what, I'm raising money. The next round of money that I'm raising is from, like, you know, the professional guys. We're going to put it on them to put a valuation on the company. We're going to put this note in right now. And if I don't have to raise money, I've been very successful with the money that you gave me. If I don't have to raise that money, then it's going to convert into stock. And I'm going to give you more stock for having given me the... having had faith in me.
Mm-hmm.
So does that make any sense? Did I?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
So let's go.
I know it's a little complicated.
Let's go now to a phase one. Now we've done seed money with the family, and we're going to a higher level.
And so it just essentially works exactly the same way at each higher level. At the very next level, the only thing you're doing, as you said in the last level, I've defined my customers, I know who they are. Now I want to go out and get those customers, right? I want to get some early evangelists, I'm going to get some beta testers, right? I need to build a prototype of the product. Or if, you know, whatever type of business that you're in, you're going in and you want to build what's called the minimum viable product. The minimum viable product is, no matter what product that you build, whether or not it's a pizza parlor or, you know, the iPhone, the minimum viable product is you put in as few features as possible so that you can satisfy the customer and you can earn $1, right? So you want to put in enough features into the product to get out there, be able to sell to your customer base, and have them wanting more, and you're going to start earning money. Now, the reason for doing this is that when you were in your first phase, that money, you're probably trying to raise anywhere from the lowest, is probably about $50,000, to probably about the highest, which is about $500,000, right? The valuation at that point in time would probably really just sink on the amount of money that you're raising. When you get to the next phase, you're raising more money, right? So you want to raise the minimum amount of money that you can, really, to achieve your goals, but enough money to sustain yourself, because you're going to have to go through experiments. So at this point in time, you're trying to raise money for about the next 12 to 18 months of running the company, right? And if your goal is to build this big monolithic product without having ever actually sold some of the product, it's going to require way more money than you really should be raising at that point in time. So you want to
okay. And by this time, it's not only you, because you've got a team, right? Since you incorporated.
And at this point in time, the other parts of what you're doing. The first time around, you had no team. It was you in the garage, writing up the paperwork and all that kind of stuff. Now you're starting to hire some people, right? you're starting to hire the minimum amount of people from an organizational design point of view, the minimum amount of people to go and support the organization as you go to try to raise this next level of capital, right? Okay. That's why they call it the lean startup, right? At every point in time, you're trying to be lean, because the more money that you raise, the more you're going to give up of the company, and we need to get into that. So at this point in time, you're raising your next level of money. Now you're starting to actually put the product out there. You have some team that's actually supporting the product. You're getting metrics and feedback now, right? So those are going to be the goals that you're going to define. And now you're going to sit in front of what's called angel round investors. Now, angel round investors can go from people like doctors who are like not your friends, right? You can find them on meetups. You can go to, there are lots of things. We're up here in the New York area, so they have these meetings all the time of these types of people where you go and you do pictures, and then they put money in. You can, you know, ask your friends. So it's like friends of friends, right? So it's not that friend in the first round. This is a friend of friends, somebody that's a stranger to you, but you know they're high net worth individuals, right? Because now you're trying to raise that next level of money, which probably is somewhere between $500,000 to $1 million to up to $2 million, right? So that you can build a product, sustain yourself for 12 to 18 months, and get the right amount of team together to support the product and its growth during that time frame. And remember, your goal is to build the product and actually be able to sell it, right? So you have to have some salespeople in there, some support people, and then, you know, the people who are going to build the product, somebody that's going to handle the money, right? Even outside sources. You have to have a small organizational structure at that point in time. Now, the thing, so I'm going to come back to this whole thing about valuation and how much money you're raising during those phases. The next two phases, you're doing essentially the same thing, right? You're listing out your goals. In fact, I always tell people to use a framework called SMART goals. That's S-M-A-R-T. It's an acronym. And when using SMART goals, you can Google all this stuff. Using SMART goals helps you to actually define a goal well and define the measurement of that goal, which is sometimes what people do not do. They'll say, I want to go to the moon. Yeah, well, that's not a goal. I want to go to the moon by June 7th. Launching out of Cape Canaveral. Okay, now we know a lot more. It's more measurable about, you know, between now and then what we have to do. So you're going to be doing that. So for every phase, you're essentially defining your goals, defining at this next level what's going to drive it, right? That's going to be increases at this point in time of just customer base, retention with that customer base, increases in cash flow, right? And from now until the end of the company, that's just how it's always going. It's always about increasing your customer base, increasing your retention, increasing your cash flow. That's what all companies are about. They build products to help them to accomplish those things. So now, with the last few minutes here, let me quickly go into a big thing, because one of the things that is that they don't talk about is losing your company, being successful, and ending up without really any company in your pocket as a founder. One of the reasons that you want to raise the minimum amount of money is because the valuation is going to be small as you go along. Remember when I first said, when you start a company, you have 100 shares, for example. If I sell you 10% of the company, right, I now own 90%. For every stage, every time you raise money, you're going to give away some of the company for the cash that you're getting. The trick, the goal, is when you give away when they buy those shares, you want them to buy them at a higher valuation, right? You want them to buy them at a higher valuation. So if I sell you one share and the value of the company is $1 million, right? And I sell you, you know, 10% of the company at this point in time. That means you have to give me $100,000 for 10% of the company. Then I take that $100,000, I invest it and do the things during this phase, and I go to the next phase. I need just another $100,000. But the value of the company, because of the activities that I have been doing, right, my sales, organization structure, these things, the value of the company has theoretically now increased. And this is where you get into negotiation. It has increased to $2 million. So now when I go for that next $100,000, I don't have to sell them 10% of the company. I am now selling them, what, 5% of the company, right? So the more money that you're raising, you want your valuation to be going up even faster than the amount of money that you're raising, because that way you end up owning more of the company.
Well, it is a lot to unpack today. I hope our audience were taking notes. There's a lot said in this episode here. The beauty of this is that it's there for you to play and replay and get the information that you need. In addition, Ron also mentioned doing some due diligence yourself, and he mentioned the form that you can actually find on Google. So there's quite a you know, work that you have to do on your part to make sure that you are well prepared to present your idea, to convince your audience, whether it is your father or your uncle Ed, to be able to raise some money. And it's also at those levels that you learn to practice and sharpen your skills, sharpen knowing that your information, so that when you go to the next level, where you are seeking money from angel investors or venture capitalists, that you are able to present in a well manner that will increase your chances to be able to raise funds to hire the people that you need to help you build your next successful project that we hope that you do. Of course, with the help of the book, that we have The Value of Your Ideas, that has a lot more information as part of your research. Pick up that book. It is very cheap for a lot of information.
Yeah, I was about to say it all ties back to your idea plus action would equal to success.
Yes, and that's a formula coined by myself in council, and as part of our book, ideas by themselves will not get you places, but if you put some action to it, you will see success. Obviously, listening to this program, we want to thank Mr. Hunter for the last two presentation and the time that he has given to us and to our audience. We'll invite you again, Mr. Hunter. Thank you.
Yes, and I look forward to peeling back the onion even more. I want to get this information out there, because in particular our community is lacking in this information, and we need to get it out there as fast as possible. And I applaud you guys for organizing and for doing this.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Albert DeKay. I can be found on Twitter at @ADECADY. Council?
I'm Emmanuel Coffey. I can be found at Coffey Law at COFFYLAWLLC. And until the next time, be well.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye now.